Okay, let's get this week over with. It's Friday. I'm Johnny DiRola. Brett Urlich is here as well for the Friday edition of the Damage Report. Brett, welcome back.
It is so great to be here with you, John. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, what a great show this is about to be.
Nice sweater.
I'm extremely excited.
You're looking very fancy.
Usually when I say I'm excited for your in-studio guest, I'm talking about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Not today.
No.
Today I'm
don't
very
need to today.
Excited for your in-studio guest.
Today you can approximate normal human genuineness.
Yeah,
and that is because we have got co-founder and executive director of the Sunrise Movement, Varshini Prakash, in studio. She has been Skyping into the show for like 6 months now, actually. First appearance the day after the Sunrise Movement's big protest outside of Nancy Pelosi's office with AOC. And we have been tracking their progress ever since. And now we get to track their geographic progress because they are on a cross-country tour of town halls and meetings and getting people fired up to push for a Green New Deal. And so she will be here in like 10 minutes, so don't go anywhere. We've also got Barry Williams is gonna be joining us to talk about AI, race, politics, the election, social media, a ton of issues, some of which we're actually gonna be touching on in this block in just a second. We're gonna be talking about Twitter. We're gonna get to the Guantanamo Bay story that we didn't get to yesterday. It involves kids because of Donald Trump. And later on, assuming we have time at the end of the show, Donald Trump makes the case for his virility as a young man. And we've got the latest on the push to get prisoners to be able to vote in states across the country. But first, Twitter. Twitter actually has fairly sophisticated tools for sort of combing through all of the many tweets that are going out there and getting rid of certain types of content. They've been able to do that in some areas, but notably not in other areas. They have opted out of policing certain types of speech that could lead to crimes, to violence and things like that. And now we know a little bit more about why. So there was a question at a meeting and one of the employees there spoke with Motherboard later on, asking why, if they can use algorithms that they've developed to get rid of ISIS related or other sort of extremist terrorist related content, why can't they do that with clear white supremacist content? And the AI focused employee said one concern with a white supremacist algorithm was that it would inadvertently flag the accounts of some Republican politicians, potentially causing a backlash. That seems to me like more of an issue with the politicians than with
right.
the algorithm.
This is a not even that tacit admission that white supremacy has been so embraced and bolstered by the Republican Party apparatus that when engineers whose job it is to just break down what's going on in the world, because that's their job. Their job is to look at things that are kind of fuzzy and find ways to specifically set them into one group or another. They are saying the problem is that the GOP is indistinguishable from white supremacists.
Or at least some in it.
Right, exactly.
Like their rhetoric, their talking points, all of that, some of their speeches, we can't necessarily differentiate that in a reliable way.
Right, and rhetorically speaking, I mean that goes all the way through to things like white privilege and how people who enjoy the legacy of white supremacy on which the American economy was originally built through slavery. It is hard to get people to admit that white supremacy is part of the American identity. And is it gonna take the Twitter engineers to say, listen, I can show you our algorithm and here is where it gets tripped up. But what do you think?
Wouldn't you love to see that algorithm?
I would love to see, I mean, I'd love to see it anyway. There's a bunch of reasons why I would love to see it just because the way it seems to work is in a way, most algorithms seem to work in a way that they just release a bunch of AI onto their previously put together AI. And it's a bunch of patches on patches on patches rather than like, here, we're gonna take this section out and put that section in.
I really would wonder. And I guess there could be some concern that there's edge cases, I guess. But my overall reaction to this is, like as there's this explosion of extremist groups over the past couple of years. It sort of, it got revved up as soon as Obama was sworn in, total coincidence. And then since Donald Trump, there's more and more of these white nationalist, white identitarian, white supremacist extremist groups. Obviously they've been responsible for horrific acts of mass violence and terrorism, including very recently. And it's easy to get disheartened when you see things like this where Twitter like is so worried about looking biased that they will do nothing even at the risk of more violence coming as a result of the spreading of these talking points. And we'll get to that in just a second. But there really is nobody coming to protect us. None of this, like the huge innovators in Silicon Valley and big data and all that. Hypothetically, it could be put to the use of bettering society, or at least lowering the risk of some of the worst sorts of extremists. But they're just not gonna do it. They're just not that sort of people. They are not the leftists that conservatives have tried to portray them for the past decade or two.
No, they're businesses.
Yeah.
They're absolutely businesses. And it's interesting, like you've got people like Facebook, Twitter, they're competing with each other, but they're not the same. Mm-hmm. In the past, you had like CBS, NBC, ABC, they're all the same, but they're all different things on the same platform. Mm-hmm. The thing about Twitter is right now, in terms of overall discourse, they are the center of it. Mm-hmm. You wanna say Facebook, maybe YouTube? No, it's Twitter, because the entire American political conversation is this crazy outcropping of Trump tweets, mm-hmm. period. And essentially, I understand why there would be pushback from a business standpoint from Twitter to be like, listen, you have a white supremacist president who is feeding what, if you look at all the other ones in terms of revenue, Facebook does way better. Mm-hmm. Google-owned properties do way better. Twitter has like a people use us, so we should be valuable right approach.
We're hypothetically valuable.
But yes, exactly. We have eyeballs. And if they were to get rid of that one thing, they would be cannibalizing their own business.
Yeah. Yeah, they should still do it though.
But they've also proven
that I think that it drives a lot of people off the platform.
Yeah, but it's hard to identify people that you don't have, mm-hmm. you know? And it's easy to say, we have those people. Why would we get rid of those people? I think the people who back off Twitter because they're just saying, like, they're more likely to back off Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and mm-hmm. all of those things and Instagram. Maybe not Instagram, but they're likely to back off all of those. And just getting rid of white supremacists wouldn't necessarily bring them back to Twitter. Mm-hmm. But getting rid of white supremacists would get white supremacists off of Twitter. And they don't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah, evidently. Okay, let's move on to a related issue. We only have a few minutes, but I want to make sure that we get to this. Do you remember just a few weeks ago when Donald Trump put up a video that appeared to be linking a newly sworn in congresswoman to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, implying that I guess she had some sort of culpability or responsibility there, and we shall never forget. Let's take a look at this. I'm not gonna play the video. We didn't then, we're not gonna now, but here's a picture of the tweet. There was a screenshot too, for some reason not there. Anyway, so it had a video of Ilhan Omar, and immediately after that was posted, there was a spike in the death threats that she and her office were facing. Obviously that is going to happen when you tell people that this is your, when the president tells his millions of followers that this is your enemy, what are you gonna do about it? Well, Ilhan Omar apparently talked with Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, and they're not gonna do anything about it. Omar pressed Dorsey to explain why Twitter didn't remove Trump's tweet outright. Dorsey said that the president's tweet didn't violate the company's rules. Dorsey also pointed to the fact that the tweet and video already had been viewed and shared far beyond the site. But the Twitter executive did tell Omar that the tech giant needed to do a better job generally in removing hate and harassment from the site. That is an amazing form of splaining for him to say to her as she is facing death threats, very specific, detailed murder fantasies against her and her staff, that he says, oh, by the way, we should do something. Yeah, that's why she's talking to you. That's the only reason Ilhan Omar is talking to you. She doesn't want an expansion of the character limit. She's not interested in easier integration of GIFs or anything. She wants to not face death threats constantly, and you're admitting that you and your corporation and your corporate culture simply value certain things over protecting women of color from violent threats and making it easier for those to come about. He wants Trump to be able to tweet. He thinks it's important. He's worried about looking biased, or he just agrees with Donald Trump. And there's a lot of evidence going back a number of years that this is not just corporate caution, that this is out and out support for the underlying philosophy of Donald Trump and people related to him. But in any event, it is depressing the extent to which they will defer to Donald Trump, even when they're like, the Secret Service needed to get involved. It became so bad in the aftermath of that tweet posting.
Yeah, but they banned death threats on Twitter. Isn't that enough? Mm-hmm. It's no. I think it's
in my experience, they have not fully banned death threats on Twitter.
Generally, this is my appraisal of the folks who run social media giants. Mm-hmm.
They, and you know, some of them.
I do. But I don't know these ones in particular. So these are me speculating on people that I don't know. The ones I do know, they are very like decent human beings. They really believe in actually like figuring out things. That's why they're engineers. They want to figure things out and open up the lines of communication to bring people closer together over time. They think that every breakthrough in technology was the main breakthroughs in technology are the ones that allow us to communicate, like the printing press, and that's how they do.
Okay, but I agree.
But with these guys specifically, they want to have a giant successful business so they can swing it out and flop it on the table and compare it to other guys in Silicon Valley. That make you uncomfortable?
No, it made me very comfortable. Great. Thank you for the analogy.
But the other thing is they don't want to be publicly shamed in front of the people who they agree with politically. Mm-hmm. And that's where we come in. Mm-hmm. We come in to say that is not okay. Mm-hmm. You are wildly emboldening these folks. And to at every dinner conversation that they go to, every time they turn on the news, they see people pointing out how ridiculous and terrible they are. Yeah. And that's what I see Zuckerberg doing all the time, except he goes back and forth like this. He goes, I believe in privacy. I don't want you to call me bad. Mm-hmm. And then he goes and says, I'm taking care of privacy things. And then there's another revelation that he did something terrible. And then that makes the news and he swings back the other way. It's frustrating that we have to do this. They have no institutional memory whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But we still have to stick around and say that this stuff is not okay.
Yeah, yeah. He believes in privacy. That's amazing. I agree. Anyway, still feel horrible for Ilhan Omar and what she's had to experience and what she will experience the next time Donald Trump or his allies in conservative media, conservative, you know, pop culture, whatever, decide to target her for their own benefit. Okay, with that, we are going to take a break. We come back. Varshini Prakash, co-founder of Sunrise Movement, in studio to talk about the Green New Deal and how we actually make it a reality.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And now I am very excited to welcome to the studio for the first time ever in studio, the co-founder and executive director of Sunrise Movement, Varshini Prakash. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad we don't have to stare at each other through a computer screen.
Exactly,
now.
With some weird lag and weird white balance
exactly.
And everything. You're actually here. So you've joined the show a bunch of times over the past about 6 months.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ever since you guys really just, I mean, you threw like a brick through the window of the establishment when you guys sat outside of Nancy Pelosi's office. Mm-hmm. And so talk to me about that. Like the, when you guys decided to pull the trigger and actually do it, getting it together, getting AOC and a few other politicians involved in it, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it all came together so quickly. Like we had basically in the months preceding, we were like, we have a situation where we know the House might that the Democrats might win back the House. And we knew, based off of previous experience, that there was no chance that they were going to actually prioritize climate change. And we'd seen this UN climate report coming out that said we had 12 years to do something drastic. And we said, we cannot afford 2 years of inaction. That will kill us. So we gathered 200 young people to come to Nancy Pelosi's office, and we actually just called AOC's team and asked, hey, can you send a tweet out or something? Mm-hmm. Can you just help us in a small way? And she was like, I'm gonna show up.
Well, I assumed you guys had coordinated that was a big part of it.
I mean, it was like 2 days before. It was like 1 day before that we asked her. She came. Wow.
That was
came
a good call.
I agree. Shout outs to our political director for doing that. But literally it was the night before she had heard of a group of kids sleeping out at a bunch of churches around the DC area, getting ready and trained for this action. And she came and spoke, and that was the most electric thing. I started crying when she showed up, because I think we're just not used to seeing politicians who go into the halls of power specifically with the purpose of representing everyday people.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were a couple of other good speeches there as well, including some very young, I think there was like a 12 or 13 year old protester.
There was a 7 year old.
Beautiful. Yeah, it was just, it was amazing to see that. So first of all, how long had Sunrise been around before that protest?
So we launched in the summer of 2017.
Summer of 2017. Yeah. Okay, so talk to me, the period from launch to the protest and the period after it, in terms of being able to get senators on the phone to organize town halls and things like
night
that,
is everything? Day.
Yeah.
Night and day, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were doing things. We were doing things definitely for the 2 years prior to. We were getting thousands of politicians to pledge to not take money from oil and gas executives, seeing the way that oil and gas money has just completely corrupted our political system and distorted science, distorted our ability to progress on climate action. We had also run this pretty extensive youth electoral program where we were getting young people resourced and trained to go full time to get climate champions into office, to become leaders in our movement, and to hold our politicians' feet to the fire when they didn't push for the solutions that were commensurate to the scale of the problem.
Yeah.
So that was what we were doing. And then it was like a switch flipped on November 13th. There were 5,000 articles written about climate change within 48 hours of that action, which is, for someone who has been working on climate change, is just unbelievable. We saw dozens of politicians reaching out to us. Now, almost every major presidential contender on the Democratic side is championing and supporting a Green New Deal. We have seen, it go from basically being this sort of niche policy idea to becoming the number one most popular policy amongst Democratic caucus goers in Iowa. And climate change becoming a top issue in America. Who would have thought? Like, people forget that wasn't the case 6 months ago.
Exactly, and even now, trying to get the media to focus on it in a substantive way is difficult.
Yes.
The coverage is oftentimes depressing, the way that they cover it, the false equivalency with climate deniers.
Right, and it's frequently about the political ping pong, and it's about, Democrats and Republicans, not about what we all have to gain in coming together to stop this crisis, about the economic prosperity associated with it, the job creation, the racial and economic justice components and all of that.
So you mentioned the major contenders in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
So I saw that Sunrise had tweeted a little bit about sort of a kind of vague environmental statement that Joe Biden had said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I only mentioned that because the field continues to expand. From your point of view, who in the field really gets it?
Yeah.
Who doesn't, and who are you still waiting to see?
Sure. I mean, I think the front runners for sure are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. We have seen, and obviously Jay Inslee, who has been championing this issue for a long time. And we have, we've seen Elizabeth Warren putting out policy papers on it. We've seen her going out and campaigning on this issue. We have been seeing Bernie Sanders saying that we need a job guarantee in this country to ensure that every person who wants or needs employment combating this crisis has an opportunity to do so, talking about how we can eliminate poverty and tackle climate change at the same time. I think the people we're still waiting on some firm answers from have been Beto, Buttigieg, people like that. And then, frankly, we're pretty disappointed in what we've seen so far from folks like Biden, but we're hopeful that we can actually, through direct pressure, through activism and more of the sit-ins and sort of public confrontation that we've seen over the last 6 months, that during this primary process, we can shift the whole field.
So it's interesting. I wonder, like 6 months from now, maybe a year from now, does Sunrise Movement endorse a candidate?
We might. It kind of depends.
So you haven't ruled that out?
Yeah, we haven't ruled it out. It kind of, we're not entirely sure. It's like 20 plus people might be a part of this. And so it's kind of like the wild, wild west right now. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a plan to endorse in this moment, but we will be endorsing up and down the ballot congressionally and in local and state races as well.
Yeah, I want to ask you something. We've talked about this before a few months ago, but we're just about to enter into the debates.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it might be that like in the last cycle, there would be no questions about climate change. That would be a massive failure on the part of CNN and MSNBC. But assuming that there are questions about climate change, as you and others at Sunrise Movement are watching the answers, what are you on the lookout for, especially with those where you're not sure about their commitment to the Green New Deal?
Yeah.
What are some terms they might use or policies they might pursue that would be a clue to you that these people are not serious about
it? Right. Well, I think we want to be crystal clear that folks who are talking about the Green New Deal need to be talking about it as a day one priority when they, you know, get into the White House in 2021 and beyond. They need to be discussing a job guarantee to stop the climate crisis. They need to be understanding the way in which climate change disproportionately impacts communities of color, the global South, working people, women, and putting forward the kinds of policies that would repair historic harm in that way. We need to see them understanding that water and clean air and clean water are universal human rights. It's absurd. Like, we were just in Detroit a couple days ago during this Green New Deal tour that we're on right now, and we were meeting with young people who gave us these vivid stories of how walking around their neighborhoods, they would hold their breath to avoid breathing in the pollution all around them from incinerators and refineries and pollution plants.
Wow. So in the area of climate change, people who want to do something about it have always had to deal with misinformation. I mean, first and foremost, whether it's happening at all, we've had to continually reassure people that, no, scientists, they're pretty sure. There's a lot of evidence, you know, there's been a few papers written about it.
Extremely sure.
Yeah. Exactly. And no, they're probably not just doing it for money. That seems ridiculous. And also, they don't have any.
Not a lot of money in that.
Exactly. But lately, since you guys have been so successful in getting the Green New Deal on the public stage, the amount of misinformation has exploded. Did you know that when AOC got interested in this proposal, she was going to pursue banning cows and planes and spending $93 bajillion on it? So talk to me about combating all of the new claims generally coming from the right against the Green New Deal.
I mean, it's absurd. It's just absurd. You remember a couple weeks ago when Senator Mike Lee was on the floor of the Senate based on the day of the Green New Deal resolution vote in the Senate, holding up images of like Ronald Reagan on a velociraptor. And I don't even know what that means. Honestly, I was very confused, and saying that like we need to make babies as a solution to climate change. And it's just, I think it just is.
It's more food for the velociraptors, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just think it shows how utterly unserious they are about this issue. And it's untenable for the future of their party. We're seeing that a majority of young people in the Republican Party, we're seeing that a majority of people in the party overall and people in America think that the Republican Party's views on this issue are out of line with what the dominant public's perception is on the issue and what we need to do to stop it. So I think it's not going to be possible for them, and they understand that. For the first time in history, Mitch McConnell has had to admit that climate change is man-made, and the Democrats have been pushing them hard to do that.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a couple questions about the organization, how people might get involved. Right now seems like a pretty good time because you are actually in LA because of a tour that you're going on.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So we realized pretty soon, we were doing all of these sit-ins and actions in D.C., and we realized, you know, if 2020 is going to be a referendum on the Green New Deal in a big way, we need to get people involved far outside of the sort of D.C. Beltway bubble. And we came up with this idea called the Road to the Green New Deal. And me and a few of my friends are like jam-packed in a van. We packed our bags. We are going from Boston to Detroit to Iowa to LA, Chico and Paradise, California, to New Orleans, Kentucky, and DC, really bringing this campaign for a Green New Deal to hopefully tens of thousands of people who've never heard about it before or are just getting involved to start local campaigns. And it's not just the sort of flagship roadshow. It's also alongside it, we are encouraging people to plan their own Green New Deal town halls in their local communities. And so right now we have over 300 Green New Deal town halls that are taking place across America. A couple days ago, there was one in Santa Fe, New Mexico, organized by an 18-year-old woman who got Ben Lujan, the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House, to endorse the Green New Deal resolution.
Wow.
She got the Santa Fe mayor to agree to a citywide Green New Deal plan. And she's 18 years old. Like,
I
these
know,
are
crazy.
Happening in Bozeman, Montana, in Kansas City, Missouri, in St. Louis, in St. Paul, Minnesota. All across the country, we are seeing these take off. And that has been the thing that is giving me so much life right now. We're not sleeping a lot. We're you know, traveling across the country, but young people are hyped up. And if you want to join a town hall near you, I would suggest folks go to sunrisemovement.org and you can find out where all of them are. There were 11 in the Bay Area, I think, just in the last couple of weeks.
Wow, that is amazing. And yeah, this is totally a time when if this is an issue that you care about, you should get involved. If it's not an issue you should care about, I don't know what's wrong with you. You totally should. You guys have been intense, I think is a great word. Even while you're driving around, like you recorded a video for our Earth Day special from the car, like working as you're, she wasn't driving, she was a passenger, but don't, you know,
I was like, everybody be
drive.
Quiet. And poke your head out at this time, say hi.
But look, as a person who, like there's a lot of issues that I care about, but this is the most important one for me. It's why I risked being eaten by a polar bear to go to the Arctic and film a docuseries about this. And just to have literally anyone that can break through the complacency and the apathy that people, I don't mean regular people even, but politicians and people in the media, the establishment have around this issue. Just thank you so much for being such a huge part of that.
Thank you.
Really
thanks for
it.
Giving us a platform to share.
Thank you. Anytime, literally, anytime you want to come on, we'll talk Green New Deal, climate change, and all that.
Appreciate it. All right.
And so sunrisemovement.org.
That's the one.
You should get involved, and you should. Thank you so much.
Thank
Great
you.
Great to have you. We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Guantanamo Bay could potentially have some new residents, and they're young because we live in an awful time after this. When it comes to immigration policy, pretty much everything that Donald Trump has thought of or given to him by Stephen Miller has been absolutely horrendous. But some of the plans that they have pursued are even worse than the ones that they have. Here's one that they were considering. In one initiative examined earlier this year, Department of Homeland Security officials looked at housing migrant children at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which has a dormitory facility that has been used in the past to hold asylum seekers. The proposal to house migrant children from the southwest border there has not gained traction, perhaps because of the optics of housing young people adjacent to terrorism suspects. I normally don't include that sort of editorializing from the New York Times or anyone else, but I like that.
But
and I think they're onto something.
It's just so strange that they were like, okay, here's an idea. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, let's look into it. We got something that houses terrorism suspects and we should put kids next to that. But that makes the most sense to me if you're in the headspace of the president.
Yes.
Because the way the president has absolutely characterized these folks is they are a threat to him. He's never really put them as, these are families trying to get away from terrible things.
Yeah.
To him, these are rapists, these are murderers. And you know who else is a rapist and murderer? The other people we have at Guantanamo Bay. So for me, if you're looking for consistency, you found it. The only inconsistent thing is that they didn't go through with it.
Yeah.
Because I was talking to someone about his plan for putting asylum seekers and just driving them to sanctuary cities. That for sanctuary cities, we did on the main show, Cenk was like, okay, fine. It's It's going to be weird. You're going to complain when they don't get back to, you know, Mexicali or whatever the city, Cali-Mex, on the border because it's so far from where you just dropped them off.
And also, by definition, you're driving them to a place where they say they're not going to comply with federal immigration laws. So.
Right. So that's your thing.
Exactly.
But it is psychotic of him to, as he's characterized them as rapists and murderers, it's psychotic of him to put those rapists and murderers in and unleash them in sanctuary city. Obviously, they're not rapists or murderers, but
he seems to think they are.
He's like, this is his plan.
Yeah, those two plans that they didn't pursue, but might, I think are perfect examples of the, like maybe the two things that Donald Trump was elected to do. So sending the kids to Guantanamo Bay. Okay, hypothetically, you could have a new dormitory, and they've apparently awarded like $23 million to build a contingency mass migration complex, which is a super fancy alliterative way to say concentration camp.
Yeah, it sounds like something on planet Earth.
Exactly. Send them there. He didn't think of that because, hey, we've got room. It was brought up because, hey, that's horrendous. And we want to punish these people. We know that they set immigration policy to please their supporters and to scare people still in Latin America who might come here. Sending kids to a place that you house terrorists in is one way to theoretically scare them. So cruelty to outgroups is one way, and owning libs is the other thing that he was put in office to do. And sending rapists and murderers to sanctuary cities, which are traditionally considered to be democratic, does not solve our immigration problem. It doesn't make any logical sense, but it does own the libs, right? And so conservatives online get to see that and think, oh, you love these people so much, why don't you take them? And those sorts of ridiculous impulses towards cruelty and like vindictive behavior towards your political opponents, that is not a way to govern a country. It's not a way to solve any problems, but it does perfectly feed the monster that is Trump's base.
He said that the Democrats have done nothing. So if the Democrats have done nothing and Trump's the only one who's done things and the immigration crisis has gotten worse, by that logic, Trump has only done things to make the immigration crisis worse.
That's true. That is true. I don't think that they will get that message. But really fast, Senator Jeff Merkley took this very seriously, tweeted, the idea of incarcerating children at Guantanamo should send chills down the spine of anyone with a conscience. This is what happens when our president is so racist that he sees migrant children as an invasion and not vulnerable children to be protected. And that is 100% true. Okay, with that, we're gonna take a break. We come back, lots more to get to. See you on the other side. Joining us now to talk AI, race, and politics, tech attorney Bari Williams. Bari, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. So in recent months, the topics of AI, race, and sort of biased outcomes have popped up a few times. And it's interesting because it's not something that people were really talking about much before that. When it comes to tech and AI and possible discrimination or unfair outcomes, what are some of the concerns that you have?
Well, first, I would start by, you know, every attorney will tell you that definitions matter, right? Diction matters. So what is AI? And the simplest way to explain it is it's essentially opinions baked in code. And the way that bias can get into that is the algorithms that are the output, it's only as good as the information that you're feeding it. And secondary to that, who is selecting the information that it's being fed? And so if you look at it statistically, the majority of people who are working on AI are, I don't want to generalize them, but they're bros, right? Like they're, you know, 25, 26 year old, straight, able-bodied white dudes. Mm-hmm. And so you're making something for a global population, but you're doing it with people who have a very, very small kind of lens and limited worldview.
So I think it was probably about 2 months ago that AOC brought up how there's this form of discrimination caused by AI, and people were like, what are you talking about? This is another gaffe from her. So what are some examples? Like for people who don't necessarily understand how this can manifest in particular cases, what are some ways that we're already seeing this effect?
So there's an interesting kind of a facial recognition. So for people that don't understand, AI is used in pretty much everything now. It is determining what ads you see, what jobs you can see, certain types of housing opportunities that may be available to you. It determines your credit worthiness. Like, there are tons of outcomes that people are not thinking about in this particular way. But one interesting misstep, Amazon's facial recognition technology last summer It was reported that they incorrectly matched 28 congresspeople with mugshots. And of course they were 28 black people. So, yeah. That's exhibit A, right? Is that imagine you're a congressperson and you're just minding your business walking through Dulles, and Dulles does use facial recognition technology. Mm-hmm. It has caught three people who overstayed visas and used fake passports that way. Interestingly, they were all African citizens. But if you're a congressperson and you're catching a flight back to your home district and you're in Dulles and you've already been mismatched with facial recognition technology, you could be stopped mm-hmm. and detained because someone thinks that you're someone else.
Yeah.
So that's one reason. And the second piece is, if you're thinking about it from a predictive policing standpoint, that's also using historical data. And we know that communities of color, particularly black and brown communities and poor communities, even rural communities, are over-policed. And so if you are using that historical data in order to inform where you should send more cops in your town, well, you're also now not accounting for gentrification, which is, of course, people who left during white flight to go to the suburbs, all of their kids are now moving back to cities. So you're sending police to the wrong places.
And you know, you've talked before about how the stakes have never been higher when it comes to this area. And it makes me think of a story I saw not long ago, actually, where I forget exactly what the company was, but it was a automated driving set of software for a car that apparently had trouble seeing black skin and recognizing that it's a human.
Right.
So you could literally be talking about life and death consequences of these biases.
Yeah, you know, I could just be minding my business walking down the street, trying to cross the street, and you know, some autonomous vehicle doesn't see me mm-hmm. and just, you know, plows me over. Like that's completely plausible. It's also the same reason why you had Google software identified, use facial recognition technology to equate black people that were using it with gorillas. And it's not cool. I mean, it's one of those things where you have to make sure that all of those voices are at the table before you ship a product. It's fine. Like products are going to go through multiple iterations. You're going to, you know, stop, start, try something, doesn't work, back to the drawing board. But you should not allow a product to be shipped and used by the public when you know that it's faulty or that there are loopholes, or if you know that you haven't fully tested it to see how does this work for people that are differently abled? How does this work if we utilize it on dark skin? How does this work, you know, if we use it on natural hair? Like, will it be able to tell the difference when I change my hair that I'm the same person? So it's thinking through all of those tests. And if you're not actually testing those things before you ship a product, then just be fully prepared to know your product is faulty.
So Bari, this is Brad, by the way. Question is, have these companies acknowledged that there are shortcomings in their programming and their AI algorithms? And are they taking steps to acknowledge it publicly? And have they made any changes or signaled that they will make any changes to improve this situation in the future?
Yeah, the good news is the answer to all of those things is yes. But I would probably put an asterisk next to that because we've all heard from tech companies, especially over the last 2 years, that they're all going to make these modifications and these changes, right? And we haven't necessarily seen that yet. So whether that's you're looking at, you know, using AI in order to combat hate speech on platforms, or if you're using it, you know, in a sensor so that you can dispense hand soap in a bathroom, until those changes are actually made, and also who is determining what those changes should be, and how are you thinking through those things, we really are not going to see a ton of gains. You may see marginal improvements, but we're not going to see a critical mass of improvement.
One last question for me. So we've talked about what corporations can possibly do generally voluntarily. In terms of government action, either in terms of regulations, legislation, things like that, what could be done to improve the situation?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that would be really interesting. I mean, for one, if you just think about it from a facial recognition standpoint, imagine now that you're going to Dulles and you're easily recognizable, like that recognition plus all of the other data that other portals have about you, that Dulles sensor can tell whether you're married, single, broke, employed, everything else. And the problem is if that kind of information and that ability to identify you is then put into the wrong hands. Like we've already seen subversion of democracy, right? When tech is not legislated. So the first thing I would do is that there should be an actual accounting and transparency in terms of where are people who are coding this, these algorithms, where are they getting the data? Who is double checking those data sets? And have you beta tested and actually tested the product internally with different employee bases or groups? Now that's a whole different bag, because we know that tech companies have issues around diverse employment. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where you can use consultants. You can use people from marginalized communities. You can use people that are differently abled. You can use LGBTQ folks. All of these people should be seeing and testing a product before it is shipped. And that is just, that's step one. Step two is transparency in terms of where you're getting the data that you're feeding it and how you're vetting that data. Those are the main two things that people should really, really focus on.
Well, those seem like very reasonable expectations, and perhaps with a change in government in the near future, we might see a little bit more discussion like that in Washington, D.C.
Let's hope.
Tech attorney Bari Williams, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Donald Trump spoke to some cameras, and so hold on to your butts. Donald Trump faces a lot of different potential contenders on the Democratic side, some of them older than him, and that led to him saying this.
Well, I think that I just feel like a young man. I'm so young. I can't believe it. I'm the youngest person. I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him. I don't know. I would never say anyone's too old, but I know they're all making me look very young, both in terms of age and I think in terms of energy.
Did he thrust his pelvis when he said energy? In terms of energy. Energy.
Ugh.
First of all.
And it was like a really vibrant, tiny little turtle head. Anyway, so here's the issue. Yeah, this is
John,
that sort of news show.
John Friday. Oh, John sorry. Fridays.
I want to apologize. The reason that I said that is that I hate him so much. And the reason I want to talk about this with you, by the way, is that you said yesterday that he's funny. So
it was funny.
Was that funny?
Craig, did you laugh?
Did you laugh with him or did you laugh at him? Thank you. Okay, now that is an instance where a Trump supporter would like that. I get it. He smiled, that signals that he's being human or whatever. Did you like that? Do you like what you've done?
First of all, thank you for blaming the Trump presidency on me. My question is, what were all those people in line for? It looked like there were so many people behind him in line. Mm-hmm. And it looked like the kind of line you see for people trying to get on a tram. Mm-hmm. Like to Disneyland from the parking lot. That's where I want to believe that all took place. Mm-hmm. His big thing against him was he's old. Trump, you're old.
Trump is old.
I do agree that Trump is hot. I never thought of it till he pointed it out, but Trump is super sexy.
Oh my God.
He's virile and sexy.
This job is painful sometimes. So I want to attack Donald Trump. That's the subtitle of my biography. In this particular case, I want to, but I'm not going to in particular ways. All I'm going to say is,
you didn't say anything after that.
I know.
You just paused.
I don't want to say anything. This guy who's young and vibrant, what is his main activity day after day? He lays in bed and watches Fox News. Like, if Fox News had existed when the chocolate factory was in existence, that's what those grandparents would have been doing. Laying around in a bed watching Fox News. That's it. Prove me wrong. You don't know what they think about politics.
He plays golf.
And that's the laziest sport. It's the only sport other than NASCAR that you are allowed to just drive whenever you want. It's like, it's not like, hey, fly ball. Like, you don't get to do that. It's not like full court press. You don't get to do that except in golf. And he gets to do that.
I don't know, I was ninth in Mission League in golf, so.
When he thinks of fancy cuisine, he thinks of a pyramid of filet of fish. And he's the vibrant, physical one. Joe Biden. Like, I don't
it's
make
weak,
me
dude.
Defend Joe Biden,
70,
but Joe Biden.
Joe Biden what?
He's definitely more vibrant than Donald Trump.
For those listening to the podcast, the entire control room was blinded by one of those Joe Biden smiles.
Oh my God, the pictures. You bastards.
That's how it's going to be. Avengers is coming out this weekend, and if he were an X-Men superhero, he would be Cyclops, except instead of his eyes, he just opens his mouth.
Okay. Jeez, okay, we don't have any time. I just love that they were waiting for me to compliment him so they could put up that creepy picture.
Happy Half Hour's back this
Happy
week.
Please back.
Watch it. Brie Esrig. We drink martinis and shoot vodka into each other's mouths.
That sounds so fun. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for watching all week. We'll be back next week. So much more to get to. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.